Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Using marijuana for medical purposes is now legal in 14 states and Washington, D.C. Here in Pennsylvania, the state government is debating whether to make medical marijuana legal. And in neighboring New Jersey, the state house has already adopted a measure and is currently figuring out procedures for cultivation and distribution of marijuana. Researchers are finding that marijuana does, in fact, have potential uses, such as treating pain and spasticity. We'll talk a bit about that later. But concern remains about whether using medical marijuana can be addictive and lead to developing further conditions from anxiety to depression. So on today's show, we're going to talk more about potential uses of medical marijuana, the associated drawback, and what the social and moral implications are. And we'd love to hear from you about this. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Well, let me tell you who our guests are. Our first guest, who's joining us by phone, is Igor Grant. He's a neuropsychiatrist and the director of the University of California Center for Medical Cannabis Research. Igor, welcome.
Thank you.
We'll also hear later from Christian Thurstone. He's a child, adolescent, and addiction psychiatrist. He's the medical director of an adolescent substance abuse program at the Denver Health Medical Center. We'll hear from him a bit later. And here in the studio, we've got bioethicist Art Kaplan with us. He runs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Igor, let's begin with you. Your research center, much of your work centers around patients experiencing neuropathic pain. Tell us what that is. What's neuropathic pain, and how does marijuana work on it?
Yes, well, neuropathic pain is a type of chronic pain that is characterized by burning, tingling, painful sensations, hypersensitivity to light touch, especially affecting the lower extremities, you know, feet and legs, but also can involve the arms. It's a type of condition that we see with people that have diabetes, with HIV disease, to name two examples, and can be quite disabling. The reason marijuana is of interest here is that current treatments for this painful peripheral neuropathy are not terrific. There are drugs in the classes of anti-epileptic drugs, antidepressant drugs, and so forth, which do have benefits, but not everybody responds. And so there is an unmet need. And based both on animal research and now human research, it looks like marijuana may be useful as another a type of intervention, either on top of or instead of these existing treatments.
Well, let me ask you something about this specific issue and the broader issue with using marijuana. The way we're looking at it now, is this a last choice, a choice of last resort?
Well, I think the way that marijuana is scheduled, that is, it's currently regarded from FDA purposes as a drug without proven value that has high potential for abuse. Given its status, I think, yes, it's at the moment would be a drug only to be considered after the existing treatments have failed. However, in the future, if this changes or if these agents become available in some other form other than smoking marijuana cigarettes, which may be more acceptable both socially and medically, then it may not be necessarily be the last line. It may become just one of many options.
You have found in your studies that there is some efficacy in with marijuana treating neuroleptic pain. I was pretty impressed with the research I saw. The difficulty with pain is something that is reported and not measured objectively. So how do you really know what's happening or even if it's happening?
Well, it's true. Pain is a subjective experience. And, of course, that doesn't make it any less debilitating than something that could be, measured in with some instrument. There are actually pretty good, even though it is self-reported, there are pretty good and reliable measures of pain now that exist. But having said that, an issue that faces any kind of pain research, whether it's aspirin or, as I say, anti-epileptic drugs or opioids. At the end of the day, one depends on patient response. So it's nothing very novel about this.
You've also studied the effects of marijuana on spasms for people who have multiple sclerosis. That's particular
yes.
interest of mine because I have a spinal cord injury and I suffer with spasms too.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you finding?
Well, in this case, we've completed one study with multiple sclerosis, but by the way, there are other reports in the literature that go beyond our research. And they suggest that indeed for some patients with MS, this spasticity, which for your listeners is just an intense cramping and also stiffness of muscles that can be both painful and make movement difficult, that these kinds of spasms are relieved, at least to some degree, by marijuana. Now, in this case, again, there are other agents that are in common use that benefit people with MS, but not all of them. And so we're always dealing with this situation that we don't have really terrific treatments, and so we're always looking for additional possibilities here. Well, and marijuana may be one such.
Well, Igor, there's one issue that I personally would say is incontrovertible about what marijuana does, and that is to relieve nausea. We know that. I experienced this firsthand 35 years ago. My wife was going through chemotherapy for melanoma, and the side effects of the chemotherapy left her so ill, she was prepared to stop chemotherapy and risk her life. And I encouraged her to try marijuana, and it eliminated the nausea completely, 100%. So, this really does have some potential here for nausea.
Yeah, and again, with nausea, actually, the situation is a little bit different than I've described for spasticity and neuropathy. Since your wife's illness, there are now on the scene very powerful anti-nausea drugs, which help most people, I would say. But again, there is a subset of people that don't benefit from them or cannot tolerate them. There's also a phenomenon kind of called late onset nausea, which is not during the acute treatment, but kind of a persisting phenomenon that marijuana may be helpful with. So yes, I agree with you. I guess my main point would be that if we could get I like to say kind of beyond the smoke on this and recognize that marijuana is just another one of a set of chemicals that could possibly be helpful.
I think
we could make progress.
I want to talk about one side effect that to me is a major issue, and that's the fact that it alters one's mental state. And to me, that raises quality of life issues. You know, if one's mental state must be altered. Of course, the other side of it, and we're going to hear more about this later, is that, you know, for people who want their mental state altered or enjoy having it altered, you know, that puts them at risk of falling in love with this drug.
Well, I think you raise a very important point that these drugs, not just marijuana, but other some of the other drugs that we use for pain management, such as the opioid drugs, do have cognitive effects and mood effects and effects on alertness. So these can be very serious for some people and need to be considered.
Are you working on anything to mitigate that? Is there,
thing I would say is that in our particular studies, actually, these are concentration-dependent effects usually. So if you use lower levels of, say, THC, you're going to have less of that side effect. And we had very many people complaining of serious either cognitive or alertness types of problems. But they do occur. I don't want to minimize them or say they don't happen. In the future, it may be possible through research to actually separate out the psychoactive and the pain or spasm-relieving qualities of these drugs. I don't know. That's a possibility. I would say one other thing, though. You mentioned a person who had a serious cancer. Under some circumstances, altering mood may actually be a good benefit in terms of pain management. Obviously not a person who needs to operate machinery or drive cars, but if somebody is terminally ill, it may be the case that having both the pain-relieving effect and the anti-anxiety and other effects may be a good thing.
We're hearing some... Igor, you there? I think we had Igor on a cell phone, and it sounds like his battery wasn't doing all that well. We'll see if we can get him back after our break. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Christian Thurstone and Art Kaplan about many of the other issues that were brought out in my discussion with Igor Grant. We also want to hear from you. We've got several callers on the line waiting to join our conversation. And if you want to, our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking about the pros and cons of medical marijuana, not whether or not it should be legalized, but medical marijuana. And then it's 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Lord's Medical Center of Burlington County, where teams combine technological innovations with holistic care to help their patients. The surgeons at Lourdes use minimally invasive procedures with the goals of reducing blood loss and pain and quicker recoveries. Trained nurses run a no-cost workshop before surgery using therapeutic mind-body techniques to reduce stress and enhance healing. To learn more, 1-888-LOURDES or online at lourdesnet.org.
FBI agent Bob Whitman chased art thieves and recovered stolen treasure. He met criminals in hotel rooms with a suitcase of cash, hoping the SWAT team next door could get there in time if it had to.
Something we always said in the undercover unit was your backup team was there to avenge you, but not to save you. Because by the time backup teams get into those situations, usually it takes too long.
Bob Whitman on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about medical marijuana. And we just heard from Igor Grant, a neuropsychiatrist, runs the University of California Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research in San Diego. On this part of the show, we're going to hear from Christian Thurston. He's joining us by phone. He's a child and adolescent addictions psychiatrist, medical director of a treatment program in the Denver Health Medical Center. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And our old friend Art Kaplan is here. He's a bioethicist and runs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi, Art.
Hi, Dan.
So, Christian, let's start.
By the way, I'm on the line in case you thought you lost me.
All right, thank you, Igor. Yeah. So, Christian, let's start with you. So, we know you're the medical director of an adolescent substance abuse program in Colorado, where medical marijuana is legal. And when we spoke with you earlier, you said you're seeing more teens walk into your clinic with problems stemming from prescriptions from medical marijuana. What are the teens you're seeing? What are they being prescribed marijuana for?
Sure. So in Colorado in 2009, about mid-2009, we had a large increase in the number of patients with medical marijuana licenses, and we had a real increase in the number of medical marijuana centers or dispensaries. And that's when we saw at our adolescent substance abuse treatment program a tripling in our number of referrals. So we used to get about 5 new referrals per month, and that went up to about 15 per month and has remained steady since then. About 95% of our referrals are for cannabis use, which is pretty standard for adolescent substance abuse treatment nationwide. About 70% of teens are referred for marijuana use. And when we surveyed the teens about medical marijuana, 90% of them know somebody with a medical marijuana license, and 60% are getting their marijuana from somebody with a medical marijuana license.
What are they being prescribed marijuana for?
Okay, well, we do have a few young adults also who are in treatment for marijuana dependence. And by the way, marijuana is both psychologically and physically produces psychological and physical dependence. And some of our young adult patients do have their medical marijuana license, and it's usually for pain. And what they describe to me, the process of getting their medical marijuana license, is that it's really quite easy here in Colorado. And I myself have been to some of the cannabis conventions and events to see what this is all about and have been offered my medical marijuana license in 5 minutes or less with no medical records needed. And so they described to me a brief 5-minute interview with a doctor who works in a dispensary, and they say that they have some pain, or they say they have depression or anxiety. And then the physician usually asks them, does marijuana help with that? And then my patients say yes, and they leave with their medical marijuana recommendation in about 5 minutes. And for an extra $30, they can get a note from the physician stating that they can have extra amounts of marijuana as needed for the severity of their medical condition.
Let me turn to you, Art Kaplan. You know, I've got friends who live in California, and they say it's a sham. You know, and something very similar to what Christian is saying, that, you know, you want marijuana, you go, say you're in pain or you're depressed or something, and you get it. Is there any way to put appropriate curbs on this, to get a handle on this? And number one, and number two, are physicians trained anywhere?
On the latter, physicians are not trained well to deal with requests about pain, to deal with requests about different treatments, including this newly legal in 14 states medical marijuana situation. So training and continuing education really has to be beefed up. Just passing a law at the legislature is not giving appropriate guidance about what to do, or, more importantly, to set a standard of care that is legally accountable. I mean, if somebody's meeting someone for 3 minutes and writing them a prescription based on that, I don't think anybody's going to argue that that's an adequate interview and an adequate assessment of what's going on. I think to your other question about can this be controlled, there are some interesting ideas around. One is to say, well, rather than have dispensaries, maybe we should have the state be the sole source of where you can get marijuana, so that you might have, I'll give you the New Jersey example. The state has decided to go forward with medical marijuana, but it may decide that the state university, which in that case is Rutgers, is the only place that can grow it and sort of grow it to quality and assess it and make sure that it meets whatever standards they want to set on it. Then they're going to be much tougher about who it is that's certified to write the prescription. And that may be a system that deserves some consideration, because it blocks this kind of what I would describe as unethical and frivolous prescription that we just heard about.
I want to come back to you, Christian, about these kids being at risk. You published an op-ed piece in the Denver Post where you said that marijuana makes anxiety, depression, and ADHD worse, and there's some rumors that kids are being prescribed marijuana for some of these things. But you went on to say that it's especially addictive for teenagers. Why are they more vulnerable?
I think that's a great point. In that,
you can't give me credit for a great point. It was your point in the article.
So. Teens are the ones who are most vulnerable to addiction to marijuana. So about 1 in 6 teens who tries marijuana develops a marijuana use disorder. And also we know that using marijuana as a teenager, teenagers have a developing brain that keeps developing into early 20s or so. And so we also know that teenagers, if they use marijuana, put themselves at greater risk for developing a psychotic disorder later on in life. They put themselves more vulnerable to developing an addictive disorder, not just to marijuana, and also having cognitive problems down the road. So teens are especially vulnerable in this. And we also know that teens are, at least in Colorado, being specifically targeted for advertisements. They're very vulnerable to advertising of marijuana, and we know this from the big tobacco story. So if you look at advertisements for marijuana in Colorado, they have pictures of beautiful young women half naked, really targeting in places that young adolescent, young adult males will be able to see this and be influenced by it.
Who's making the money?
Who's making the money?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you talk about advertising, then somebody's... Yeah, where
I think that's a great point. There's a lot of money involved in this right now. We know, according to the Denver Post, medical marijuana dispensaries are making about $10,000 a day. We know that Coloradans for Medical Marijuana Regulation, which represents a lot of the medical marijuana dispensaries, has 4 full-time lobbyists in the state capitol. We know that a lot of money has been pumped into the organizations that are supporting medical marijuana legislation. So we know that agencies such as the Drug Policy Alliance Network, funded by some very wealthy philanthropists, are pumping a lot of money in toward the getting medical marijuana legal.
So let me turn back to you, Art, as the ethicist. Is there any way to keep this more like other medication?
Well, I think there is. And I think when these legislators have passed these laws, they didn't intend to either create a backdoor route to legalization, nor did they intend to kind of target teens with pain complaints. I mean, I don't think that's the priority here when we're talking about medical marijuana. I think we were back at the terminally ill, the people with glaucoma, the people who had side effects of chemotherapy, people with spasticity. That was the range of folks that I think we were trying to make this substance available to. And I think the answer then becomes we have to have tighter control on what the doctors are doing. Medicine is not distinguished, I have to say, by weeding out abuse, but it's got to get tough here, because if they're basically using this as a marketing and promotional device with people writing prescriptions for anyone who comes in and claims pain, that's unacceptable.
Well, wait a minute, though. Cymbalta? I mean, don't antidepressants do exactly the same thing.
Oh, I think they do, and I think it's exactly the same problem. I think we've seen abuse of the, if you will, FDA-approved drugs, off-label uses, and taking them down into children populations with nasty and terrible results, deaths and suicides and all kinds of problems. The industry is being fined left and right. I don't think I've gone a week now without seeing somebody slap a fine for abuse of psychiatric drugs in children, and this seems more of the same. So very quickly, what I would say is, let's toughen up the standard of care that's expected for prescription. I mean, outline exactly what it is that you're supposed to go through in terms of doing an evaluation of someone. I certainly would be interested in seeing some sort of restriction by age. I don't know why you have this population running around at 18 getting these drugs. And I think the state might take a more active role in controlling who can dispense. What we're hearing about in Colorado is kind of a traveling carnival here with people dispensing, you know, left and right without any serious evaluation of the person.
Do you know of any states who are doing it better than what we're hearing in Colorado?
What I hear is a lot of abuse in Montana, a lot of abuse in Colorado, a lot of abuse in California, and that's made some of the later adopters, Pennsylvania thinking about it now, and New Jersey, think much harder about who's growing it, where can you get it, and how controlled it's going to be. So I think it'll be very interesting to see what New Jersey does.
Hopefully we're learning. Let's go to the phones. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We'll start with Summer. Summer, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm not sure which of your guests had mentioned this, but somebody said that there's been a threefold increase in the number of teenagers who've been referred to treatment centers for marijuana in, I forget, they said maybe the past year.
Yes.
I mean, that certainly sounds like a shocking number, but how does that compare to the number of teenagers admitted for stimulant abuse or alcohol abuse or any other type of drug abuse? Has everything risen similarly, or does marijuana stand out with statistical significance?
Well, Christian, you were the one that that brought that up in the first place.
So that speaks to our own experience here in the Denver area in terms of referrals for adolescent substance abuse treatment. If we look at prevalence rates of adolescent drug and alcohol abuse trying to get at comparing 2009, when medical marijuana really took off, and comparing that to 2008, when it was much less available, we're still waiting on those numbers yet. It takes a while for that to come out. It looks like recently prevalence of drug abuse in teens has been steady, with some small increases in marijuana use, and people predicting, we would certainly predict an increase in the future given the changing attitudes, with teens viewing this now as more of their medicine as opposed to something, a drug that could be harmful to them.
Do you think these kids would be getting marijuana anyway? Christian?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think the answer is yes, a lot of the teens would be getting it anyway, but we definitely know from prevention science that the more available something is to teenagers, the more they use it. So that's why alcohol and tobacco are by far number one and two in terms of substances used by adolescents. They're just much more available. Second thing is perceived harmfulness. So when perceived harmfulness goes down, then teen use goes up. And so same thing with alcohol, tobacco, perceived as less harmful. And we would predict that as marijuana becomes considered a medication to teenagers and advertising of marijuana changes their attitude regarding marijuana, that their use will go up as well.
Hmm. I want to come back to you, Igor. You study, I believe, exclusively smoked marijuana rather than pills. Why is that?
Well, we began, you're correct, the Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research at the University of California was actually set up by the legislature After the passage of what we call Proposition 215, which was, I guess, must have been the first state initiative that made marijuana legal for medical, certain kinds of medical use. But what the legislature wanted to know was, well, what is the evidence that smoking, you know, marijuana is actually medically helpful? And so that was our original charter, and that's why the first study.
And have you found anything yet? Is it more effective than pill form?
We have not done head-to-head comparisons with pills, although there have been a few studies on that. I can come back to that in just a second. Because the other approach that we're studying is something called vaporization, which means that the marijuana product is heated to a temperature below combustion, so it's not smoke, but enough to reduce the emit the vapors, including THC and so forth. And there's some evidence now that that is just as effective as smoking in terms of the THC.
Yeah, with
and so forth. So that may be an alternative way. Just to comment on the Marinol story or the pill form, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it is not as good. I don't think there is a very good set of medical studies. But what we do know is that absorption from the gastrointestinal tract tends to be delayed and that the concentrations of THC tend to be lower, at least at the recommended doses.
Well, that's,
maybe if
I think
you quadruple the dose, you will get the same.
Yeah, I think that's interesting and valuable information. We're gonna have to take a short break and continue our conversation in just 60 seconds. We are talking about medical marijuana, the pros and cons. If any of you would like to join the conversation, our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We've just got a couple of lines open. We've been listening to Igor Gran, a neuropsychiatrist who runs the University of California Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research in San Diego. Still will be with us after the break is Christian Thurstone. He's a child adolescent addiction psychiatrist. And here in the studio is Art Kaplan, a bioethicist who runs the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The University of Delaware's Lerner College of Business and Economics supports WHYY. The Lerner College offers an internationally accredited MBA designed to meet the needs of experienced professionals. Classes are held evenings at convenient campus locations in Wilmington and Newark, Delaware, both minutes from I-95. Financial aid and scholarships are available for qualified applicants. For details, 302-831-1200 or online at mba.udel.edu.
Each year, there are more than 3 million suspensions of public school students nationwide. In some districts, though, black students are suspended at many times the rate of whites. We want to ask why, and what good does it do?
We typically discipline them by denying them school time. So we're actually making the academic problem, which is at the root of the problem, worse.
We'll talk about that next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about medical marijuana, the pros and cons. We're with Art Kaplan, who runs the Center for Bioethics here at the University of Pennsylvania, and Christian Thurstone, who's a child and adolescent addictions psychiatrist, and he's out in Denver, and he's seen a threefold increase in the number of young people coming to him for treatment for marijuana addiction since medical marijuana laws were passed. Let's go right to the phones here. We've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. We've got Gwyneth on the line. Gwyneth?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was just commenting on a previous call-in about the effects of Marinol. I had taken Marinol for a trial period with Johns Hopkins in a clinical study that they had done for my fibromyalgia, having previously smoked cannabis before. And I was wondering about the synergistic effects of the different cannabinoids with just isolated THC that they're using, is what I understand. Now, when they take away the other important cannabinol, and would this necessarily just show that THC by itself, would that show that it's effective in and of itself? Because there's a lot of, like the previous caller said, a lot of anecdotal evidence that says that, you know, a lot of the gastrointestinal absorption of the medication is not titrated like smoking would be.
Yeah, I don't know if we are beyond anecdotal evidence. I don't know if we still have Igor
on the phone
or not. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is Igor Grant. I can address the caller's question a little bit if you'd like.
Please.
Yeah, well, so the first part had to do with that cannabis, of course, has many, many constituents in it. There are, 150 maybe different kind of compounds in there, and we don't know what all of them do. There is some suggestion that at least one of the ingredients called cannabidiol, which is not a psychoactive cannabinoid, that is, it doesn't make you high, may have some anti-inflammatory and also anti-pain actions. And there's also been some suggestion, though I don't think very well researched, that the cannabidiol may actually reduce the high produced by the THC. But as I say, that is sort of a suggestion in the literature, but has not been very well researched. So we don't know enough yet about the combinations. In terms of the oral form, I think it's pretty well shown that there's been studies at NIH, actually, that the absorption of THC from the gut is much less efficient than through the lungs. And that the levels you get from the typically prescribed dose are probably a quarter of what you get from smoking. Now, you could increase the oral dose, obviously, and that might increase efficacy. Problem may be if absorption is delayed, you may get sort of a severe side effect,
and
a few hours down the line.
And that you can't control.
Yeah.
I hope that was helpful, Gwyneth. It certainly seems like it answered your question pretty directly. I want to raise a question with you, Christian. You know, we've been asking Art a lot as the ethicist about what can be done to control things to make things better. First of all, to you, do you believe there's any reason for medicinal marijuana to make it legal for medicinal purposes?
I think I'm hopeful that there's use for medicinal marijuana. I think that, like everything in medicine, there are pros and cons and side effects and benefits and that need to be weighed. And so my own personal opinion would be to wait until researchers like Dr. Grant do more studies, more phase 3 and studies on alternative delivery systems and really looking at the ingredients, the cannabinoids of marijuana that we were talking about, and waiting until those data are available and those delivery systems are available until we have medical marijuana would be my preference. I think a couple other thoughts on that. If voters do really want medical marijuana now, I think Art had a great point in terms of the tightest way to control it would be with a state-run system. I think that would also really be able to control the advertising and marketing that I think can also drive demand that may not necessarily initially be there. And I think also that in Colorado we had a pure caregiver system for the first, we've had medical marijuana in Colorado since 2001, and from 2001 to about 2008 we had a pure caregiver system. And so we had about 5,000 patients per year receiving medical marijuana under that program. And then when dispensaries came on board in 2009, we went from about 5,000 a year to about, now we're over 90,000 patients per year, which is about 2% of our entire state population. So I think a pure caregiver model where you designate somebody to grow marijuana for you is also a tighter way to do this than our current system of having medical marijuana centers.
Art, weigh in on that. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think you can't hold hostage people who are really benefited by smoking marijuana. And I'm ready to say there's evidence enough that a lot of people who are ill, sick, chronically ill, do get benefit. So they can make their choices. They can decide, you know, if they want the risks that might come at older age. But at the same time, turning this into a kind of pseudo-industry, we've already legalized direct-to-consumer advertising, which is the subject of a whole other show, but I will simply say it's a disaster to be promoting this where kids can get a hold of it, and having unethical practitioners basically run marijuana mills under the guise of medicine. These are clearly unacceptable policy. You have to have growers that are legal. You have to have the state take an interest, I think, because they don't have the incentive to promote. They simply are going to listen to recognized medical requests to supply. And then I think we probably want to step in and say there's certain people who have a license to dispense. They're the ones you got to go to, and let's see how that goes. And I'm remaining neutral on the general question of should we legalize marijuana. It's in the background here. It's clearly a slippery slope issue for many. For me, there is a point, there is a purpose. You hear enough people saying they want to benefit, but I'm not sure you have to unleash the entire tidal wave to capture that demand.
Hmm. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ken on the line. Hi, Ken.
How you doing, Dan? Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. Just a comment. I cared for a very sick woman, for my wife, for roughly 20 years. She went through many operations and then eventually wound up in the last 3 years of our marriage diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And what we found was marijuana was the only thing, as you had commented earlier, that would control the nausea. So my real comment, though, is it seems as if the assumption is that once the research is done, and the decision is made pro or con for this substance, that we enter it into the system and it becomes another form of treatment. And my comment is that I saw absolutely no aftercare follow-up of any sort while my wife was addicted to opiates as a result of prescriptions for many years. And I think that what we have to be looking at, not only when we're talking about bringing a new substance online possibly, is not just, is this a beneficial substance, and not just how do we control it. And all these things, I agree, are necessary, but shouldn't there be a practice in medicine or specialty in medicine that deals with taking care of people as they're going through the use of a pain medication and talking to them and helping them through this? And I saw absolutely nothing. My ex-wife was hospitalized 3 times for drug psychosis, and I felt like there was no help there. I was desperate, and I'd like to hear a little bit of discussion around that particular issue. Who's out there walking through this with these people? In my experience, it was nobody.
You're bringing up an important issue, and you're bringing up an issue that we have devoted a show on and probably need to devote more shows on. Art, I want to ask you to weigh in, and I'm just going to capture one piece of his question, and that is, he said, who's taking care of the patient who is addicted to other drugs? But the bigger question is, who's taking care of the patient and not just the symptoms? And this is where the marijuana thing raises questions in my mind. Yeah, pain, go smoke this, and then you feel better and I feel better.
Well, we certainly have seen the emergence of subspecialty palliative care. So that's a good thing, and that's starting to operate more, and that kind of early intervention to manage both pain and the broader idea of suffering is starting to get some prominence. There's certainly pain specialists out there, but very few, and sadly, the distribution of this expertise is pretty spotty around the United States. But to get right to the heart of your question, Dan, I think at the end of the day, for home care, outpatient care, these kinds of chronic management situations, we haven't really built that infrastructure. What you're asking about isn't out there. It's good when you're inpatient. It's good when you're in a supervised setting. But as soon as you're out, we're just not set up to do it. And I think it's one of the great tragedies of the recent health reform debate that we didn't talk about that.
And that's where most health care is taking
place. That's where most
health care
takes place, by family members.
Right, right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Frank on the line. Frank, hi. You're on Voices.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering, why isn't the only distribution being considered, which I haven't heard mentioned, is the pharmacy? They distribute all other drugs. Many pharmacists are PharmDs. They could monitor it. They monitor pulmonary problems. They monitor diabetes. Why I haven't heard that at all in your conversation.
Good point. Let's bring it up with both my guests. Christian, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think the explanation for that is that it's a Schedule I substance by the FDA, and so they, by definition, it cannot be distributed through pharmacies. And then second of all, I don't know how pharmacies, I'd like to hear some of the other guests talk about it, but I don't know how a pharmacist would dispense marijuana leaves and say, go smoke this. So logistically, I don't know how that would work either.
I wonder, Igor?
Igor, Grant, do you want me to comment on that?
Yeah, could it be distributed through pharmacy?
Yeah,
should it?
I think, first of all, Christian brings up the important point. We've talked about state regulation, but there's a whole issue of federal regulation, and federal law takes preeminence in many of these areas. And as he pointed out, the marijuana right now is a Schedule I drug, which basically translates into a useless drug that's very harmful. That's overstating it, but that's kind of what's in Schedule I. And so one way to encourage the research and clinical trials that were suggested earlier is to move it into some other Schedule II or III that would then make it much more palatable for physicians and investigators to do this kind of research. That's point number one. Point number two is, if marijuana were manufactured up to standard and quality control and so forth, like Dr. Kaplan mentioned, it could actually be supplied as pre-formulated cigarettes. That's actually how we get our marijuana from the federal government. It has a farm at the University of Mississippi. We request a certain number of cigarettes at a certain potency, and then we administer it to our medical participants according to whatever the
you have laid out a path. Thank you. Yes. Thank you, Igor. Art, I want to turn to you. You know, we've talked a good deal about marijuana and the side effects, and I brought up, you know, quality of life issue and impaired cognition, but, you know, we also have that with OxyContin and morphine and so on and so forth.
Alcohol.
But people don't talk about those as quality of life issues.
You know, I think that's very interesting because at the end of the day, I'm going to say the ethics of dealing with quality of life questions or mental perception of self is not considered very much part of the medical model. It's sort of the lost boy of all this discussion. And on the other hand, when you're terminally ill, when you're facing, you know, disseminated bone cancer, I start to think these are desirable states sometimes for people to go to. They're not all bad. Quality of life is not something that gets measured, evaluated, or rewarded very much in our medical system. It just it doesn't rate, if you will. Yet for patients, I think it's probably a primary consideration as they deal with disease.
That's the only reason we pick up the phone
exactly.
to call a doctor.
Exactly.
Is that the quality of my life is not what it was yesterday.
And yet
there's no other reason.
And yet if you look at our metrics for saying, is this worth doing? Quality of life isn't really there in the same way that we might say, you know, are we getting this pain control? Can you measure this? How's that going? You might say quality of life is too subjective to pass muster in what's increasingly an evidence-based orientation to what's going to be made available.
And yet pain is...
It's about as quality of life subjective as you're going to get.
Yeah, yeah, and a diminution of pain really is everything, especially for this neuropathic pain, which, you know, pain, like many symptoms, pain demands attention. And if you're in a great deal of pain, that's what your life is about.
And again, I don't want to say that I haven't met an adolescent who could meet this model, but given where the legalization has gone, it's ignoring where I think we started, which was the group of people that you're talking about right now. We weren't meant to have a place where we had a traveling wagon coming around dispensing marijuana by someone who talks to you for a minute and a half and says, you got any pain? Does this help? I mean, that model is not what was intended.
So I guess I'll ask you, Christian, that if we get this right, as Art suggests or hopes, that down the road states are getting smarter about other states' mistakes, do you think we can double back to Colorado and hopes that they improve things? Well, maybe we're out of time. Maybe we can just hope that things double back to Colorado and things get improved. And like I said, unfortunately, we are out of time. And I want to thank all three of you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
My guests have been Igor Grant, who's a neuropsychiatrist, director of the University of California Medical Cannabis Research. Christian Thurstone is a medical director of an adolescent substance abuse program in Denver. And bioethicist Art Kaplan is here in the studio. He's director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Hey, tomorrow, July 13th, there'll be a book fair at Barnes & Noble at Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia. I'm going to be there later in the evening doing some book signings from 6 till 8 p.m. in support of the children's charity Variety, which has an autism initiative. I love to see you out there. Come on out between 6 and 8 and say hi. If you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org, and I'm at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is producer of audio content. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Stephanie Marutis is going to be taking a brief leave of absence. We wish you great health and happiness in your brief leave of absence. And we welcome a new producer, Jennifer Lynn. Thrilled to have you on board and part of the family. Evan Pliss is our intern. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.